Senate Subcommittee on Elections will come to order. It's Thursday, January 22nd. A quorum is present. It's our understanding that a couple members are on their way, and a couple of our members are down in Judiciary right now, and will be checking in at different times. But the first bill on the calendar is Senator Eakin, Senate File 46. Senator Eakin, this is a mail balloting authorization modification to your bill, please.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And I would like to move Senate File 46 be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Rules and Administration. And I also do have an amendment to the bill as well.
Great. So if the clerk could please pass out the amendment. So it's in the packet, yes. Do you want to go ahead and start to describe it, Senator?
Sure,
Eakin?
Sure. As far as the amendment is concerned, again, that's just to get it in the shape and form that I would like. It's just clarifying that the provision saying a town of any size can be anywhere in the state, but not cities below 1,000. They have to be outside the metropolitan area. So it's just a clarification. That's what the law intended last year that was passed. So that's the amendment. And do we have to vote on the amendment first and then move on to the bill?
Yes. So Senator Eakin moves the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape he would like. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment passes.
Aye.
And Senator Eakin, just to remind the committee and the public that last year we modified the mail balloting so any township of any size outside the metropolitan area was allowed to use mail balloting if they chose. And so this bill, now in the shape you have it before us, would allow for a township anywhere in the state, and it would modify the city requirements of what cities would be eligible to do mail balloting. Is that correct?
Right, Madam Chair. It does. I guess last year it was passed that a township of any size anywhere in the state could be anywhere in the state.
Oh,
this
okay.
is the amendment just clarifies it to make clear that that does not apply to the cities part of it.
I see.
Because it wasn't clear the way it was written. It could be interpreted to mean that cities could be located anywhere in the state as well. And so we're just clarifying that the cities would be outside the metropolitan area, but townships can be anywhere. Yes.
Okay. I see.
So, and Madam Chair and members, so last year there was a change that was passed regarding the townships, but cities were stipulated to have less than 400. We're trying to increase that to 1,000 registered voters before they could implement mail ballot voting. The reasons behind this, for one thing, it gives more local control to those cities with fewer than 1,000 registered voters. Many of these cities, because they are smaller, do not have the financial resources that many other cities do, and mail balloting is more cost-effective. And for that reason, there are some that would like to entertain that option as a possibility. And also in townships where voting has been done through mail ballot, they have shown that it has increased the participation level in those places where it's being used. That's another argument that some have used in favor of this. As I said, more local control. Also, in the rural areas, we tend to have a more older population, and that can be inhibiting for some on election day, especially if the weather's not good. So that's another argument in favor of this, increasing it to 1,000. MACO does support this legislation as well. I also have today Ann Lindstrom is here also from the League of Minnesota Cities to answer any questions that people may have that she might be able to answer. So with that, I would open it up for any questions from the members.
Senator Eakin, I would imagine that small cities, as it's time for precincts to acquire new voting equipment, that this may be an appealing option for some of those smaller cities where buying an assisted voter technology and the other voting technology that they need is pretty expensive, or it's very expensive for counties, smaller counties, and local units of government. So I would think that this would be appealing. That's why it's also appealing to some smaller units of government.
Yes, Madam Chair, that's absolutely correct. And when Secretary of State Simon was here, he was talking about the equipment that was being purchased for the Help America Vote Act. That equipment doesn't last forever, and much of that equipment is going to have to be replaced soon. So this is another option available to some of those cities, again, many of which are more financially strapped, to allow for this option of mail balloting, which would not incur the same level of cost and hopefully would result in greater participation as well. But that's a very good point. The equipment is very expensive, so it's more costly even without buying the new equipment to have polls open and people manning the polling booths and so on. But especially if you've got equipment that needs to be replaced, then it becomes much more expensive. So,
discussion? Is Senator Kiffmeyer.
Unless you had something else to say, Madam Chair. Good to see you.
Me too.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I just remember previous committees in regards to mail balloting. And one of the things that you hear over and over again, these are very expensive ways to conduct a voting because the mailing out of a heavy envelope, and you have to add the postage for return. And these are places, for the most part, that have a high voter turnout, much higher than the state average already anyway. And so the premise has always been that that very small precinct having, you know, there's a certain point where you kind of might say where you have a price break, although my personal philosophy is that when it comes to elections, the most fundamental process we do in government, and that just using cost is a very, I think, short-sighted perspective because it's about deciding who will represent you, who will handle trillions of dollars, millions, billions, or hundreds of thousands, such as in a township. But every single one of those really have an impact. So I see the value of an election and the maximum amount of information many times. So I did get really concerned about this bill and the fact that so many others have commented before, and now all of a sudden they're making this change, which is in direct opposition to things that were said before about the expense of the absentee ballots and sending them out. Well, this is the exact same expense in this sort of a process as there is in absentee voting. So I just have real concerns. I just want to mention, too, that the I was an election judge some years ago in a mail balloting experience, and it was so miserable that the group of us as election judges said that we would never, ever again be part of it because it was just a lot of questions and a lot of concerns that went on at that time. So I really have, I kind of have that sticks with you quite a while when you have that kind of negative experience. The other thing is that there are two issues in regards to equipment. The precinct optical scan equipment is very tried and true and solid, very cost-effective, very efficient in the counting, checking for errors. And one of the great values of voting in a precinct is that you have that advantage for that. I think the biggest question that I hear is the equipment that is used for people who have disabilities, the AutoMark equipment. And there are options out there now to greatly reduce that cost that I'm certain that when they get to that place that if they want to do that, they can take a look at what they have. Frequency of use, some other things, and even in the programming, but there may be some other options out there that will help in that regard. Rather than giving up, which I think the voting in the polling place is one of the great American experiences of going to the polling place and casting your vote, and especially when you do it on election day. So those are just some of my concerns about this, and I've shared them before. I don't think I've ever really supported it. So I'm just being consistent with my approach and what I believe about elections. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Is there anybody in the audience who wishes to testify on Senate File 46? No. With that, Senator Ekin moves that Senate File 46, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Rules and Administration. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion passes. Senator Ekin, thank you. The next bill on the agenda is Senate File 47.
Yes. And
do you have an amendment for this? Oh, no, you do not have amendment for this bill. So to Senate File 47, please.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair and members. And so I would like to move Senate File number 47. And the I have with me today Jack Davies, who had brought this bill to me. What this bill does, it actually doesn't change much in state law. What we have right now, we do have a faithful presidential election or electoral provision in state law right now. What this does is it just creates language that's uniform with other states that have this provision so that we have the same language. And that's why it's called the Uniform Faithful Presidential Elector Bill. So it doesn't really change much. It does make some smaller changes, developing a more comprehensive process for alternate electors. But maybe before I just mention that, I should talk about what the faithful elector provision is. It's to make sure that electors vote for who they pledged to vote for. And we have had some issues with that in the past. In Minnesota, we do have one example in 2004 when an elector voted for Edwards instead of the one that they were pledged to vote for. And in that case, obviously, it didn't have an impact on the outcome of the election. But if you have a close presidential election, an unfaithful elector could throw the election one way or the other. So that's the reason that we put this into place. There have been other times in the past in other states where there have been unfaithful electors as well. And we'll probably have I have with me the former president of the state Senate here, Jack Davies, who could probably talk about some of those situations. But so we have this provision in there right now. We have alternates who are selected to replace electors if they are unfaithful. And the elector has to take a pledge that they are going to vote for the person who they pledge their vote to. And if they don't, they will be immediately removed and replaced by an alternate who will then hopefully vote for the person that they pledged to vote for. Otherwise, they too would be removed and replaced. So that's to, again, ensure that the electors vote for who they were pledged to. So it's already in practice, but there have been, I think it's four other states that have done this now.
Five
other states that have done this as well. And we're all trying to adopt the same language so that we can make a stronger case to other states to do the same thing. It's kind of like, we all want to be in harmony so that people will listen to us. Because if we're not, it's less likely that other states might listen. So we're trying to create some momentum here for other states to follow the same suit, because we're interested in having faithful electors, not just in Minnesota, but across the country, because we're not just choosing a president for Minnesota. We're choosing a president for the whole country. And what happens in other states matters to us. So we're trying to start the momentum here through this Uniform Faithful Presidential Elector Bill. And so most of it is just to bring, doing the same thing, but just bringing it into conformity with the same language as other states use. There are some small changes and modifications to current law. It does develop, again, a more comprehensive process for alternate electors. It requires that each elector be paired with an alternate. Right now, the way it works is they're chosen by lot. There's just alternates out there, and if the elector is unfaithful, it's chosen by lot. Now we have an elector with an alternate designated for them. That's probably the biggest difference. It also makes a modification in the date and time when electors are required to meet, just a practical change. But other than that, it really doesn't change the substance of what we currently have in practice. And with that, I do have, Senator Davies here to testify to the bill.
Judge Davies, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape.
My name is Jack Davies.
I'm a uniform lodge commissioner from Minnesota and have been for a long time. And that may explain some of the history of how the Uniform Act came to be. When we had the one elector who either from senility or deafness voted for the vice president candidate on the presidential count, we were embarrassed, and the Minnesota Senate and House corrected that situation. And I took their product and that story to the Uniform Laws Commission, and that caused the Uniform Laws Commission to take up the subject, and that's where the Uniform Act came from. It's nice to know that that mistake was made in the west wing of the Capitol, but on the first floor, not on the second floor. But it helped very much with each enactment, the ease of selling a Uniform Act in the next state increases, and therefore we want Minnesota to be on the scale helping sell this Uniform Act elsewhere.
And Judge Davies, you said that five other states have adopted this language already?
That's not quite accurate. There were four states, along with three others with Minnesota, that dealt with the problem in an effective way. One state now has picked up the Uniform Act, so we have five states that in fact have uniform law in effect, but they haven't adopted the words yet. So it's a new product of the conference, so we have not had much time to sell it. But Minnesota passing it will be very helpful.
Is there anybody in the audience who wishes to testify on Senate File 47?
And Chair members,
Senator Davies.
I want to put one other piece of history in. This bill passed the House last year. It was passed the Senate in a conference in an omnibus bill, and somehow that added enough weight to that omnibus bill so that it was thrown out in conference. But so both houses have already passed it.
Already passed it both. Interesting.
I don't recall. Funny how quickly I forget. Is there any discussion among the committee members? Seeing none, Senator. sorry. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Madam President, having been around as Secretary of State for that infamous opening up the ballots and seeing the Edwards name, knowing what this could mean, you know, and I know the situation well. Unbeknownst to you, though, there was another situation where it was not a faithless elector, but we had a wild snowstorm that day, and a elector, and it was always interesting. Electors, the farther away they were from, the earlier they got there. It was the one who lived a couple miles away in Minneapolis, didn't show up on time when we had to use the alternate. Well, then he showed up, hugely upset after all the work he had done, that he was not able to serve. And so Governor Ventura's general counsel and my staff put their heads together to come up with a way to manage to figure it out, because we understood the unique circumstances. He wasn't just late because he overslept. And so they all kind of worked it out. But it wasn't a matter of a faithless elector, but there's always interesting stories with this. But, you know, when I read through this, Madam Chair, I just see an awful lot of language that has huge consequences. And I don't recall supporting this in the past. I don't know exactly where it came from. I can certainly check that. But it's interesting. But a lot of language, because one person was not faithful to what they had pledged. And I'm of general belief that if they want to be unfaithful, this looks like it's putting a lot of language in place, but it's kind of too bad.
Senator Eakin.
Yes.
A response to that.
Well, Madam Chair, and Senator Kiffmeyer, I agree that it is quite a bit of language, but I think it's just replacing language that's similar, that's already, but the repealer took out a lot of that language, so we're just putting back in language that's similar to what we already had in law. So it's not as much language really being replaced. It's a lot of the same language going back in again.
Good. And I appreciate that. And Madam Chair, we have not reviewed this in our larger group, and so I just want you to know it's not that I'm absolutely opposed, but I can't support it today. But, you know, I'm certainly open as it goes further.
So Senator Eakin moves that Senate File 47 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Rules and Administration. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails and the bill is recommended to pass. Thank you, Judge Davies and Senator Eakin. Senator Carlson, Senate File 205. While we're waiting for Senator Carlson and his testifiers to come to the table, members, in your packets are the minutes from the last meeting on January 15th. Senator Hayden moves approval of the minutes. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Carlson, Senate File 205, and I understand you do have an amendment that would get the bill in the shape you would like.
Yes, Madam Chair. Shall I move the bill before we do the address the amendment?
Move the A2 amendment, which, members, as I said, is in your packet, and this is the first committee this bill has committee stop this bill has made this year. So Senator Carlson moves the A2 amendment to get the bill in the shape he'd like. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. So, Senator Carlson, to your bill is amended.
Madam Chair and members, thank you very much. I have Senate File 205, which is a bill that is somewhat agency, somewhat minor changes and clarifications to the Campaign Finance Board duties and requirements. I have Mr. Gary Goldsmith here, the Executive Director of the Campaign Finance Board, and he will be able to answer any detailed questions about the bill. But first I'll go through some of the major portions of the bill of the language that we're changing. Primarily, this is an efficiency change, a clarification change, and some detailed changes. Section 1 requires the board chair to designate a member to promptly make a determination as to whether a complaint alleges a prima facie violation. The current 15-day deadline is removed. The notification to the subject of the complaint given prior to the determination is no longer required. The board must issue an order within 60 days after the probable cause determination is made. That used to be the 60 days after the complaint. So that's been changed slightly. This section also requires individuals or associations to preserve evidence.
Excuse me, Senator Carlson. Senator Kiffmeyer has a question on that section.
My apologies, Senator Carlson. I have an amendment in front of me. Did you?
We moved the A2 amendment to get right. The bill into the shape he would like it.
Right. And so I just wanted to be sure that I understood that your testimony, because there's a lot of
You'll
changes
go through
here.
The changes.
Is that what he's doing now? Is explaining the changes? Because we didn't do it when we adopted the amendment.
So, Senator Carlson, as you go through, as you run through the bill, could you just note where there were changes made in the A2 amendment?
I'll try to do that. That might be a little difficult, but I think we can do that. I'll have to get my copy.
That's what you're asking, right?
Okay. Well, maybe we'll go over the changes first in the A2 amendment, and then we'll come back to the because what I have is a description of it as amended.
Okay.
So, Madam Chair, we'll have Mr. Goldsmith go through the changes that have been prompted by the A2 amendment.
Okay. Okay. Mr. Goldsmith, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Gary Goldsmith, and I'm the Executive Director of the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. There are three significant changes in the A2 amendment and then two very technical changes. The first significant change is in the A2 lines 1.1 through 1.9, and that relates to what is called the prima facie determination. There is nothing in the actual bill about that determination. What this does, first of all, there is two steps before the board can begin an investigation. The first step is the chair makes a determination of whether the document that's been received actually constitutes a complaint under Chapter 10A. And the current process is that the parties are given a chance to weigh in on that preliminary decision. They're given 15 days, then the chair has some time to make the decision, and then we move to the second step, which is a probable cause determination, where the board actually decides whether to investigate or not. What this language does, it still leaves the prima facie determination in the hands of the chair, just like it was before. What it eliminates is the ability of the respondent to weigh in at that stage. The chair will make the determination based simply on the complaint, because this is very preliminary, and it just is to decide if it is, in fact, a complaint under Chapter 10A. So what the effect of that is that will speed up the process by about 45 days, and so the matter will actually get to the board for the first real action much sooner, and that first real action is where the board looks at the complaint and says, do we need to do an investigation, or should we handle the complaint in some other way?
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Goldsmith. Now, can you help us understand, because last year the purpose of the prima facie was the thing about transparency, and this does not take any of that transparency piece away. That was a big concern of both Senator Newman and myself, correct?
That's correct, Senator.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
The second part of the A2 amendment is on lines 1.10 through 1.12 of the A2 amendment. In the bill, as Senator Carlson goes through it, you'll see some provisions about judicial contribution limits. And the reason for the change in those limits was because judges aren't all up for election in the same year. So we can't tell for any particular candidate whether it's an election year for that candidate or not, which means we, the board, can't tell if they should have an election year limit or a non-election year limit. And so we were proposing to change the limit to be the same for each of the two-year segments. The bill actually proposed a lower limit for district court judges than for appellate court judges, and the judicial community reached out to Senator Carlson and myself and indicated that they preferred to stay the way the law currently is, with the same limit for all judicial candidates. The second change from the original bill is that staff had inserted a number in the limit, making it $1,500 for each year. Previously, it had been $1,000 in the two-year segments where there is no election and $2,500 in the election segment. Again, members of the community reached out to us and pointed out that the really key two-year segment is the segment where the judge is up for election, and the current bill would actually be reducing the amount that a judge could take from a contributor during that two-year period. For many candidates, that's the only period that they'll be raising money. So the amendment makes the limit $2,500 in each of the two-year periods instead of $1,500. Lines 1.14 through 1.24 are new. There is no corresponding language in the bill itself. And this is a board recommendation. It's an implementation of a board recommendation. The board recommended that the legislature address the ongoing litigation in the case called Seaton versus Weiner. This is the case in which the board is currently restrained from enforcing the large contributor component of the special source limit. We did not enforce that limit during the last election a year because we were precluded from doing so. Based on what Judge Frank has said in the case, namely that he believes the plaintiffs are likely to prevail, it is likely, we think, that that injunction would become permanent. And so this would simply do what the judge has already done on a temporary basis. It removes large contributors from the special source contribution limit and strikes the definition of large contributor, because that definition is not used anywhere else in the statute. The effect of this will be, if passed, will be to make the Seaton versus Weiner litigation moot. The statute will have been changed to implement what the judge has done on a temporary basis, and will have the effect of cutting off any future attorney's fees that would be incurred if we go forward with a full trial. And then lines 1.25 and 26 put in place a letter C where we simply omitted one and refer to 10A.022 instead of 10.022, a typographical error. And the last three lines change the title. The title calls the bill an act related to ethics, and really this is an act related to campaign finance. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. So, Senator Carlson, you want
to... Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, I'm going through the bill as we have amended it. So I'm going to start back on Section 3, delays the 10-day grace period for filing disclosure of public officials' representation of certain clients, and adds adds $20 to the fee of a late penalty, not to exceed $1,000, which is up from $100. These numbers have not been changed for many years. Section 4 requires each individual who is required to file a statement of economic interest to do it annually. This was a change where it was an unchanged or unfiled statement would be just continued. So this actually requires an affirmative filing of it.
Senator Carlson, can I interrupt you to ask Mr. Goldsmith a question? Mr. Goldsmith, on this section, when you and I discussed it a while ago, I suggested that it may be easier for candidate committees to file this type of annual statement at a time when candidates are already filing other reports. And I believe, if I recall, you were going to think about that. Did you come up with any explanation for or any reasoning for not changing it to like an end of the year statement where we're already filing our other campaign finance reports, or why keep it at April 15th?
Madam Chair and members, I have thought about it. I have not had a chance to bring it back to the board. But from the board's perspective, there is no magic date. I actually had a discussion, I don't think it was really confidential, with Senator Kiffmeyer, and she made a suggestion that I thought made sense, and that was that the period of the report would run on a calendar year. That's much like the chair's suggestion, because it's at the end of the calendar year when people get their 1099s, they get their brokerage reports of transactions from the year, and that's when you can most easily see what your reportable transactions and sources of income might have been. So I didn't feel that I had, I don't have any board recommendation, but at the same time, the board certainly is open and has no position on whether there ought to be a change in this to either make it through December 31st or some other date that the legislature might think is appropriate.
Okay, we can continue to think about that. Sorry to interrupt, Senator Carlson. Please proceed.
Madam Chair, Section 5 clarifies that all the data in an audit are not public and not accessible to the subject of the data. This is consistent with the terms used in the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act.
I'm sorry, Senator Carlson, could you speak up? This is consistent with what?
Consistent with the terms used in the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act. Microphone a little closer here. Section 6 adds a new triggering date for the first registration of a political committee. And this triggering date requires both the registration and report to be filed by the report due date if the $750 reporting threshold is met. So there's this might bring it up earlier if that threshold is met. Section 7 specifies that an independent expenditure or ballot question political committee or fund must register also by the earliest of three dates. The new triggering date is added that requires both the registration and report to be filed similarly by the report due date if the threshold has been met. Section 8 deletes the 10-day grace period for filing a first registration form. The late filing fee is $25 per day. That's an increase of $20, up from $5, not to exceed $1,000, up from $100. Section 9 specifies that the disclosure statement for an independent expenditure does not apply to individuals or associations that are not required to register or report under Chapter 10A. It also mentions the disclosure statement requirements do not apply to small items, for instance, a campaign button, where it's inconvenient to print the disclaimer, or to advertisements where the inclusion of a disclaimer would be impracticable. And this includes online banner ads, where they might link directly to an online page that does include the disclaimer and is required to include that disclaimer. Section 10 specifies if a political committee or fund, campaign committee, or party unit receives or spends $750 on or before the last date included in the reporting period, the entity must both register with the board and file a report for that reporting period. Now, this is consistent through the bill now to make sure that reports are included if they actually reach that threshold by the last day. Section 11 provides that a candidate who did not file for office is not required to file the campaign report that would ordinarily be due on June 14th. Section 12 requires a filer of a campaign report to include the board registration number, if there is one, for individuals and entities. Section 13, and by the way, this adds to the ease of being able to search out individuals or contributors that may or may not have errors in the name or may have more than one name. Section 13 specifies whether the expenditure limit is for the election segment or the election cycle, and those are two very distinct periods. Section 14 was covered in the A2 amendment, and that amends the contribution for judges and fixes it at $2,500. Section 15 deletes the references to large contributors, and that also was covered in the A2 amendment. Section 16 removes party units from the prohibition on contributions to candidates during a legislative session. Section 17 specifies that a regular session includes the entire first day and the entire last day of the annual session. And really this makes sure that you don't have to go to the clock to find out when contributions have been made if the Senate convenes at 11 o'clock that morning and there was a contribution at 9 o'clock that morning. So it just makes things a lot easier on the Campaign Finance Board reporting. Section 18 states that a willful issuance of an official refund receipt from the contributor to a candidate, I'm sorry, from form to a contributor from a candidate who did not sign a spending agreement is subject to a civil penalty of up to $3,000. The willful issuance of an official receipt is classified as a misdemeanor and is also subject to a civil penalty of up to $3,000. Section 19 specifies that unless otherwise provided, the board may impose a civil penalty up to $3,000 for a violation of any of the Chapter 211B, which is under the board's jurisdiction. Section 20 adds a cross-reference in the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act, as was mentioned before, to the board data provisions in Section 5. Section 21 deletes language that is replaced by new language in Section 19, again referring to the civil penalties. Section 22 modifies some of the disclaimers required on campaign literature. New language is added to specify that the disclosure limit requirements do not apply to small items, where it's inconvenient, again, to print the disclaimer. Section 23 adds political committees, political funds, and party units to the exception that allows entities to give more than $100 to a charity if the committee is dissolved within 1 year after the contribution. Section 24 specifies that a political party, organization, committee, or individual may not accept a contribution from a corporation that is prohibited from making contributions. Section 25 requires the costs of complaints relating to a statewide ballot question or an election for a statewide legislative office be paid from the appropriations to the Office of Administrative Hearings instead of from the State Elections Campaign Fund. And I believe this actually codifies something that is already done. Section 26 reorganizes existing statutory language into other subdivisions or newly created statutory section. And Section 27 repeals the Minnesota Statutes 10A20, a Subdivision 1C, which is reports of certain political party units, and rules, Part 4503.1500, Subpart 2. And that's on the unpaid year-end balance of loans. And what that means is that a loan that exceeds the amount that the individual can contribute during the year is subject, it is controlled by this. You cannot use just the end-of-year loan amount. You have to not exceed the amount during the year also. So with that, Madam Chair, I'll stand for questions or for any clarifications from Mr. Goldsmith.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you, I met with you, Mr. Goldsmith, and in regards to on page 12 and the amendment, so there was the original language, which was just judicial office, and then it was amended to the appellate court with numbers changing around of contributions, and then now that seems to have been undone. And I remember, so what was the explanation for having, before the amendment, what was the explanation for including appellate court to that? If you could refresh my mind as to why that original language was in there.
Mr. Goldsmith.
Madam Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, I'm not sure if your question. Let me, give me one moment. Madam Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer, I'm trying to determine why we specified it appellate court, which is the senator's question. I understand the question, and I see that we struck the new language. The reason for the placing appellate court in the original bill, which amended the original statute, is that at lines 12.31 through 33, we were going to establish a separate lower limit for district court judges. So appellate court judges would, in the original bill, would have had the $2,500 per two-year segment limit, where district court judges would have had a new $1,000 per two-year segment limit. So we had to add appellate court to separate them out from the district court. Under the A2 amendment, we've stricken the language on 12.31 through 12.33. We've also stricken the new language on line 12.28, so the word appellate court is now gone again. We revert to the original statutory language. So the only change now in the after the A2 amendment is that on line 12.29, where the original language said $1,000, it says $2,500. And on 12.28, where it said $2,500, that remains. So the result is that all judges have a $2,500 two-year segment limit each year. And the judges came to us through their representative and indicated that because limits had always been the same, or at least had previously been the same for judges regardless of what office they were running for, that they would prefer to have the limit, again, the same for all judges. It's easier for them to explain. I already mentioned the fact that it's really the last 2 years of a judge's election cycle that are important, and so rather than dropping that last two-year segment, it seemed more prudent to increase the earlier two segments.
Senator Kissmeyer. Really still a little bit. Okay.
Other discussion. Senator Lemon, you missed a good summary of the bill, so we want to make sure we answer any questions.
No.
I think it's a great idea.
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on Senate File 205? Seeing none, Senator Carlson, if I could continue to weigh in with you and work with you on the date of that report, I would appreciate that, but I'm not ready to propose any language right now. But perhaps we could work together on that as the bill moves forward. Seeing no further discussion, Senator Carlson moves that Senate File 205, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Rules and Administration. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. The bill is recommended to pass.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Carlson and Mr. Goldsmith. Members, at this point, we do not have a meeting scheduled next week, so our next committee meeting will likely be the following week. So seeing no other business before the committee is adjourned.
I don't like noon bed. I don't know what's going on. I got no more friends. I want noon bed.